Tired of blogs?
Me too. Moby Lives Radio starts now. Intergalactic headquarters of Melville House Publishing in Hoboken, New Jersey, aka the Left Bank of New York City, it's Moby Lives Radio.
It's Tuesday, the 8th of November, 2005. I'm Dennis Johnson, and here's some news. We start today with some sad news, a hail and farewell to British novelist John Fowles, the author of The French Lieutenant's Woman. He's died at the age of 79. His publisher in Britain, Jonathan Cape, announced that Fowles had been ill for some time, although they didn't say of what. If you were a college student in the 70s, you probably read his other well-known novel, the cult favorite, The Magus, and you might even know how to pronounce it. Maybe it's The Magus, I don't know. Back here in New York, one of our leading independent presses, the Soho Press, is losing their publisher and president. Co-founder Juris Jurjevics announced that he's leaving the company to return to Emerson College, where he will teach in the graduate publishing course. The PW Daily report on this seems to suspect that this is connected somehow to the fact that Jurjevics last year sold his very first novel, The Trudeau Vector, to Viking in a six-figure deal. Meanwhile, fans of Hunter S. Thompson are going to be able to see him get blown out of a cannon. That's right, the much-publicized event that took place this summer, but was sealed off to members of the press, has been captured on film. Apparently a filmmaker was allowed in. In fact, it was Wayne Ewing, who had previously made a film called Breakfast with Hunter, when Hunter was still upright. He was allowed to film the ceremony at Hunter S. Thompson's Woody Creek, Colorado property in the remote mountains of Colorado this summer, whereby Thompson's ashes were blown out of a cannon encased in a 15-story tower. The film called When I Die will be shown on Saturday at the Stars Denver International Film Festival. And the extravaganza of the event this summer, the film, the whole kit and caboodle, was paid for by actor Johnny Depp to the tune of $2.6 million. That's a good friend. In France, it is the heart of the literary prize season. They cram them all into 2 weeks every fall, and they're well underway there. Yesterday, it was announced that Turkish author Orhan Pamuk has won one of the most prestigious of the several prizes. He won the Prix Medici for Foreign Literature. The French version of the Prix Medici was won by Belgian writer Jean-Philippe Toussaint for his novel Fur. Pamuk, by the way, won it for his novel Snow. Meanwhile, the Prix Femina, another of the biggies, was announced yesterday, and that's another award for a foreign writer, and in this instance, it went to a truly foreign writer, Joyce Carol Oates, for her novel The Falls. The Femina, by the way, as it is explained in my Agence France-Presse wire story about the awards, the Femina Prize was set up in 1904 by a group of women to counter what they saw as the misogyny of France's best-known literary award, the Goncourt, which was established in 1903. And what is a French literary season without some controversy? This year it centers around the fact that the most famous of them all, the Prix Goncourt, did not go to Michel Houellebecq, although he was heavily favored. Apparently, it went to François Weyrguin for his novel Trois jours chez ma mère, 3 days at my mother's house. That sounds like something worthy of a prize to me. And finally in the news today, according to Editor and Publisher magazine, if you've got a copy of Lewis Scooter Libby's lone novel, The Apprentice, you may be sitting on a gold mine, if not a masterpiece. They're reporting that the book is fetching all kinds of money on various weirdo internet retailers, such as those strange used categories on Amazon.com. They report one ad running as follows: inscribed mint pre-first edition copy of the book. Uncorrected page proofs in brand new mint condition with inscription handwritten by Libby himself. It says the inscription reading, "To Bob. I hope you enjoy it, Lewis Libby." Okay, we learn a couple things there. He doesn't sign his name Scooter. That's encouraging for his family. However, who's Bob? Could it be Bob Novak, who reputedly doesn't know how to read? So we don't know. But let me tell you something else that the ENP article tells you about this book. It gives a little description, a little synopsis of the plot, and it runs like this. The Libby book conjures a young Japanese man who runs a remote mountain inn and becomes trapped in intrigue, it says. The book includes incest, a hunter who wonders if he should shag a freshly killed deer while it's still warm, and a girl kept in a cage and raped by a bear to train her to become a prostitute. Your tax dollars at work. That's the news today, the 8th of November, 2005.
It's November 8th, and on this day in literary history in 1900, Margaret Mitchell, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Gone with the Wind, was born. Gone with the Wind, Mitchell's blockbuster hit, was written while she was convalescing from a broken ankle. But Mitchell was so unsure of her writing that the book almost never saw the light of day. When asked by friends, she would vigorously deny that she was even writing a book at all. But one friend's stinging comment, "Of course, you could never be a serious writer. You don't take life seriously," finally goaded Mitchell into handing off her manuscript to Macmillan editor Howard Latham, who was scouting in Atlanta at the time. She arrived at Latham's hotel just as he was preparing to depart, with her huge manuscript piled high. "Take it," she said, "before I change my mind." Latham bought an extra suitcase to accommodate the giant manuscript and took it back to New York. When Mitchell arrived back home, she was horrified at what she had done and sent a telegram to Latham saying, "Have changed my mind. Send manuscript back." But it was too late. Latham had read it, liked it, and soon sent her an advance check. There was no turning back, and Mitchell's book went on to sell more copies than any other hardcover except the Bible. And it was the only book that Margaret Mitchell was ever to write. I'm Valerie Marians, and that's This Day in Literary History. I know my chicken. You got to know your chicken. I know my chicken. You got to know your chicken. I know my chicken. You got to know your chicken. I know my chicken.
Jessa Crispin is going to be one of our regular commentators here on Moby Lives Radio. Jessa has become well known for running what may be the most popular book blog in the country, bookslut.com. And lately, she's also been writing a regular column for the trade industry publication, thebookstandard.com. In fact, one of Jessa's recent columns at the Book Standard was about a really terrifying poll. I called her in Chicago to find out if I could believe everything I read. Jessa Crispin in Chicago is the proprietor of Bookslut.com, but also the author of a column in the Book Standard. And this week, Jessa, you wrote about a poll of some sort whereby it was discovered that 33% of all book buyers, and this is to quote you, only bought a book to look smart. What is the poll you're talking about?
The Guardian did a news story, or a story that they trumped up as news, saying that in the past 33% of all people have bought a book only to look smart, not to have any intention of ever reading it, just to have it on their shelves or carry it around with them in public, or tell their friends that they bought it, but that they never actually had any intention when they bought the book of ever reading it. And the books cited are the kind of obvious ones, Brief History of Time and Salman Rushdie's books, which I've read, but evidently nobody else buys with any intention of reading.
So you both read them, and you're looking good to people.
Yes, yeah. Yes. You want to look sexy carrying around Stephen Hawking in public.
So what were the other reasons they were hearing from people? Did it say, or did it just talk about the preposterous reasons?
No, I mean, it was just it was a fluff piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, oh, we did the survey. And they didn't really explain why they did the survey or what they hoped to get, knowledge they hoped to get out of this. But yeah, it was just to make themselves look smarter. It was kind of the end. And then from that came other articles that were, these are the fashionable books of the fall. You know, buy these. You don't have to read them, but you'll look better.
Yeah.
And I just thought the whole thing was getting really ridiculous.
Do you believe it? Do you think it's true?
Oh, absolutely. but at the same time, I don't know why that's news. And I don't know why they framed it of, you know, I'm sure some of these people actually thought at some time they might read the Stephen Hawking book, you know, mm-hmm. and then they read one page and decided, no, it's out of their range or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
that wasn't really mentioned in the story.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe I'm optimistic about people.
Well, I mean, if you do believe it, I think the follow-up is it something peculiar to the moment, or has this always been true?
Well, I think that, you know, even when Charles Dickens was fashionable, you know, books have always been status as well
mm-hmm,
as
mm-hmm,
entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, yeah, there's probably been a lot of this. I mean, 15 years ago, there was some sort of survey that was released that said Stephen Hawking's book was the most bought / least read book of all time,
mm-hmm.
Or the least read bestseller. And so this story has been coming around and making the rounds for a while now. It's just that, you know, this time they took a little bit farther and wrote all these other articles about it.
Well, you mentioned some other interesting books in the column that might give people a perspective. For example, you talk about citing the Adams biography by David McCullough,
right?
Which was a huge doorstop of a book,
mm-hmm.
Which was terrifically well received, a huge bestseller, lots of great reviews, and yet as you joke, nobody finished it.
Yeah, well, I know several people who started that book and never got past, you know, page 200 or whatever.
What? I think it expands the concept if people realize we're talking about actually kind of mainstream books and not just Hawking and you know, scientific books or learned books in particular, but just kind of pop books as well, taking this on. I'm wondering if you could think of some other examples. Are books being published to look good or to make the readers feel like they're looking good?
Well, I think that's what the whole, you know, every once in a while an author is deemed as being the hot new thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people bought the Jonathan Safran Foer book, you know, more than actually read it. And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, same with Zadie Smith and authors like that. You know, they're fashionable for reasons that have nothing to do with their actual content of their books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, you know, that crosses the line of sort of why is this person the spokesperson for this generation of writers? Because, you know, they look good on the cover.
Or right.
Because they're deemed the hot thing by the New York Times or
right.
whoever.
Well, speaking of the New York Times, they had an article in recently that has been the talk of the town here in New York. I don't know if it has been in Chicago as well, but it was an article about Simon & Schuster's Spotlight Entertainment imprint and how they are going to unusual places to discover books about the pop culture, as the article put it. One of their most famous books being He's Just Not That Into You, which actually wasn't a book they developed, but landed on their doorstep, although the Times reported and seemed to realize everybody else in New York had rejected it, much to their regret. But in any event, we have an imprint being fostered as an alternative to the rest of publishing, and it seemed like what the Times article was saying about this very sleek new house was that they are exactly on top of the kind of thing you and I are talking about, books that look cool, that seem to be leading a trend, that are about something other than substance.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I have met this woman, Jennifer Bergstrom. I was on a panel with her at Book Expo, and this is the woman who heads up the imprint.
Right.
And it was capturing the elusive 18 to 34-year-old reader.
Mm-hmm. And that was the subject of the panel.
Right. And her thesis that she wouldn't get away from was that 18 to 34-year-olds don't read books,
mm-hmm.
or they don't read literature, and that they read self-help, they read young adult novels, and then that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so her theory of SSE is...
Is that the White Sox train going by your house?
I have no idea what that is. That's like some sort of plane hovering. So her theory of SSE is to create non-books.
Mm-hmm.
Is to
non-books.
Create things that should have been magazine articles,
mm-hmm.
but now in book form and costing $15 to $25.
Well, the quote I came away from this particular article was her praising her editors by saying, "The thing that impresses me most about our editors is that they understand it's not about the book, it's about the money you can make from the book."
Yeah, it's the book as, as product, as, she could be selling books or she could be selling baked beans.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter to her.
Mm-hmm. So if we've got a survey saying people are buying, or a third of book buyers are buying books because it'll make them look cool, and we've got another article highlighting the proprietor of a publishing house publishing non-books, is there any hope for us at all as a culture, Jessa?
Yes, there is. I don't really believe in this sort of dire predictions, and I think I may be way too optimistic about people, but these articles, I just think, he's just not that into you phenomenon, and everything else has come from SSE, has just been, I guess it's making them money, but you have to wonder, if they weren't there, nobody would miss them.
Mm-hmm.
They're completely disposable, and
mm-hmm.
and they are. I was reading, an interview with Joe Mino, the author of Hairstyles of the Damned.
Mm-hmm. One of the great titles of all time.
Absolutely. And he was saying that they're not taking money from literature.
Mm-hmm.
These book sales are not, people aren't buying these instead of buying the new Julian Barnes. They're buying them instead of buying magazines, and magazine sales are hurting. But that's their market.
Mm-hmm.
And so, whether or not, it's like the chiclet phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
People say, well, at least you're reading something, but
mm-hmm.
it doesn't really translate into other book purchases.
Just keeping some scary people off the street.
Exactly.
And out of the libraries. Jessa, thank you.
Uh-huh.
At Melville House, one of the best independent bookstores we've had the chance to deal with has been the Athena Bookshop in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And in the weeks preparing to launch Moby Liz Radio, we were planning to use one of the booksellers there, Susan Ramsey, as our Kalamazoo correspondent to tell us what people were reading in that part of the country. Only a problem has developed. After being in business for 6 decades, the Athena Bookshop is going out of business. We reached Susan Ramsey at the Athena Bookshop to file what we nonetheless hope will be the first of many reports, in this case to tell us about the demise of Kalamazoo's last remaining independent bookstore.
Susan Ramsey at the Athena Bookshop in Kalamazoo, what happened?
Oh, it's never just one thing. It's like divorces. Parking and personnel and a lack of warm bodies walking through the front door that since July, our numbers were down 70%, day after day, week after week. And at a certain point, you decide that a death by gangrene is an ugly thing,
mm-hmm.
and you just decide to stop, have a big party, and lock the doors.
That's an incredible drop, 70% since July. That sounds like something in particular might have sparked a drop-off.
Well, the drop-off over the years, I think that one of the small obvious thing was the demolition of a parking structure that's nearest to us, mm-hmm. and a certain amount of construction. This is Michigan, and we have two seasons, winter and construction. So that wouldn't have surprised people that much. A much bigger problem for us were corporate mergers and move-outs. Kalamazoo has always been very organized around the Upjohn Company, which became the Pharmacia Company, mm-hmm. which moved out a lot of people, mm-hmm. especially from downtown, which mm-hmm. then became Pfizer, which had another round of moving outs. So there was also a bank, which moved, never did say how many people they moved out, but it had to be 400 or 500. So in the big picture, we simply lost so many daily warm bodies that one paperback, that one newspaper, which could have supported us, mm-hmm. was not happening. Mm-hmm. And then I think we also could have made it through that and the slow summer months if it had been absolutely convenient for people to get down here. Mm-hmm. But we're spoiled. Mm-hmm. It was not utterly convenient, and we've been here for 61 years, so I'm sure everyone thought, not that they weren't going to come, just they wait until it was a little easier.
Mm-hmm. So you're in the heart of downtown Kalamazoo.
We are. We're on the Kalamazoo Mall.
And those are the local reasons. Are there other reasons,
sure.
beyond the local that
yeah,
you can
sure.
relate this to?
Every book that anyone ever bought online, every book anyone ever bought at a big box. We did have a big box come into town to drive out a much larger independent, and they succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
But then in addition, we have the, virtually every huge discount store now notices what the biggest bestsellers are, and they're able to sell those frequently for less than we can buy them for.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Potter didn't save us this summer. We had expected that he would, and it's just too easy to buy him elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Is the store the lone independent in Kalamazoo now?
Yeah, it is. Even the other one had originally been downtown. The larger one had then moved out to a contiguous suburb.
Uh-huh.
And that is, so we were never, one of the killer bees was not out to get us because
mm-hmm.
we were too small to see, and they don't go into downtowns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons we're so sad, is that downtowns, we like downtowns.
Yeah.
We don't like malls particularly.
Yeah.
It's a dandy downtown.
Yeah.
It's going to be slightly less dandy without a bookstore. We do have a wonderful newsstand. It's the last of the great 1940s newsstands.
Mm-hmm.
The Smithsonian's going to drop a bell jar over it any day now. But they don't do hardcovers.
Well, tell me about Athena. Tell me what does the store look like? How big is it?
A bowling alley. We're a long, narrow store with what looks at first glance like a fieldstone fireplace. Kalamazoo's a small enough town that people walk in, get halfway through, and then you can watch the town turn a quarter turn in their brains as they go, this used to be
uh-huh.
some previous store in 1942
uh-huh.
and a different one in 1927.
Uh-huh.
It is our fourth location, and the one that people were always fondest of was a little, more New York, a little areaway you would go down into and
mm-hmm.
open the screen door and step over the sleeping Cocker Spaniel and ask Mr. and Mrs. Johnson for a book, and they would get up and walk around and move five piles of books and reach in behind, and they always had your copy of Cold Comfort Farm,
mm-hmm.
whatever you were after.
Mm-hmm.
Not
an easy book to find, usually.
I don't think we've ever not had it.
Wow.
I think it was the first book I bought here, and it's one that I've just sentimentally always kept stocked. Part of the fun of working here was always that the staff was always allowed to order in whatever they wanted to
mm-hmm.
carry. We were allowed to schedule whatever events we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be one of the things we'll miss, is that this was about the only place in town where there are a lot of writers in Kalamazoo. Our standard line has always been that you can't throw a brick without hitting a poet, and some days it's tempting.
Mm-hmm.
And the universities bring in the big important people from away. But if you wanted a sense of what was actually going on here,
mm-hmm.
Stuart Dybeck is local. You know,
mm-hmm.
you could follow people of considerable acclaim or people who were just coming into their own.
Mm-hmm.
and being able to follow that year after year, you could get a sense of, you could build a community, mm-hmm. you could have some diversity. Mm-hmm. Donald Hall talks about the mech poem, very disparagingly. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to be a little less distinctive. We're going to be a little more homogenous with this gone.
What is the university in town?
Western Michigan University, and then there's also Kalamazoo College, which is a small liberal arts college, but which brings in wonderful, amazing people.
And do those schools have bookstores as well? Was that part of the mix?
They have
in town?
School bookstores. They uh-huh. don't have a yeah no uh-huh. they there isn't a.
So what's the landscape going to be now? It sounds like there's one chain store in town, and is there more? And
there's a used bookstore mm-hmm. which had started. There are several used bookstores, mm-hmm. and one of them, which is the largest, they have two branches here, and are the largest dealer in used books on this side of the state, had begun bringing in some largely best-selling books, mm-hmm. And they're going. I expect will probably. Stepping into, we had always been, we vended for the university readings. We would get the books for them and vend. Mm-hmm. And at the when the public libraries, both here and in the our neighboring suburb, had appearances, we would generally be the vendors for those as well, mm-hmm. which is profitable less often than you would think. Mm-hmm. Once yeah. you have to do the returns when the event isn't a success.
Right. I know the other end of that equation very well, as a matter of fact. As a publisher, but
returns.
Yeah, how do you think the community will respond? The news is rather sudden, and the store is not going to linger on through the Christmas season, but rather close down on November 12th. What's your sense so far of the community's reaction?
Oh, they're wonderful. They're distraught. Mm-hmm. We've had people standing in the store with their eyes filling. Mm-hmm. We've also had people who come in, smile at you, and say, you know, I haven't been here in years.
Mm-hmm.
Are the discounts going to go deeper?
Mm-hmm.
But much less of that than I had actually expected.
Mm-hmm.
We sent out an email to people, and then we were on the front page above the fold the day that George went down to tell them we were closing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had wonderful notes and emails and letters and people stopping in. We also started discounting immediately, and we are practicing the finest form of smoke and mirrors, where you turn it face out, cluster them together, keep it looking abundant, move it to the front of the store.
Mm-hmm.
But we are sorry that we're going to lose contact with those people. Our book group, for example, mm-hmm. we had one of the the women here are in several book groups, but this was really the best one that we knew, because the people initially didn't know one another socially, so there was no temptation to discuss or obligation to ask how the kids are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You could actually talk about the book, and it was a really diverse group. Meeting at an odd time had helped. We've always met at 5:30, mm-hmm. so people could come straight from dinner and leave. And the book group is saying, okay, and we're going to meet where now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think.
Well, what happens in the store itself? What happens when a bookstore closes? I mean, do you have to have a final sale? What happens to the stock?
You try, mercifully, I'm the person that they try to keep as far away from any actual numbers
mm-hmm.
as possible for the good of the store.
Mm-hmm.
I know that George has talked to people who specialize in bookstore closings. Mm-hmm. He's read articles on it. There are different schools of thought. We're going to discount and drop the discount every week for 3 weeks, and then some of us will still be around for a few days after the doors close
mm-hmm.
to help him figure things out. We have, for example, oddities, like we have a good many consignment books because we're the local store.
Mm-hmm.
A good many people have books here with us, and we have to figure out their accounts and get the books back to them somehow. So we'll be missing that, but we will not necessarily. We may have gotten out just in time to avoid drowning in the flood tide of print-on-demand, which is coming in. But we'll miss being able to schedule author events for authors that we have run across either at the Great Lakes Booksellers Association convention,
mm-hmm.
when we reluctantly stuck around to listen to someone because a local author was reading in the same session.
Mm-hmm.
It was Michael Perry of Population 485, who's a EMT and a fireman, who is a joy and a delight. And we were able to say, we're not important enough for you to come to deliberately, but we're between Detroit and Chicago, and if you were passing by, we think if we had enough time. And he was wonderful, and we did work something out. And on a January Monday night, we had 60 people in downtown Kalamazoo for him, in cases like reading websites like Moby Lives, where you hear about Rob Lafner's novel Our Nun, and get sent a reader's copy and fall in love on the first page. We could have our book group do it, and then we were able to arrange to talk to the author by speakerphone.
Right.
So.
And it was a great event.
And that kind of luxury, you know, that's what we're going to miss. It's not like we were paid enough so that the income can't be replaced.
Right.
But the luxury of being able to indulge yourself by getting in touch with these people.
Right. Well, forgive me, a final post-mortem question, but just what else happens in a bookstore when it decides to close? I mean, what happens to the bookshelves? What happens to the register and the furniture in the back room?
We just had someone walk in saying she happens to own a bookstore in Indiana, and could she talk to George about the fixtures? Mm-hmm. We have a cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has already asked us about buying the popcorn maker.
Mm-hmm.
Never underestimate the profitability of popcorn in a bookstore. On the other hand, the espresso machine, you know, this is like taking out a small car loan. We won't miss that either.
Yeah.
We had I think Boeing made our cappuccino maker, and it always, a cappuccino was always required at the most emotional point of a poetry reading. this is the sort of thing George is going to have to figure out. Something may end up having to come out of his own pocket just to be able to close. Advanced readers' copies. We're drowning in advanced readers' copies here.
Yes.
Things that publishers send you.
Right.
That we've got. We could insulate the place.
Yeah.
And they're not. You know, you can't resell them.
Right.
So that's not a possibility. We don't know. We started at 25% off, and it was apparently it looked like the beaches at Dunkirk here. It was a frisky day the first day of that.
Mm-hmm.
And come the last day, we'll have dropped it to 50%, and we're going to put on Zydeco and Kaylee music and Zorba the Greek
and
cut
dance.
The cake and dance and lock the doors.
How many people work there?
Oh, we'll find out. That will be November 12th.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, how many?
Oh, I'm sorry,
how many
employees? Four senior staff members. The owner and three senior staff members, and then four or five girls in the cafe.
And where are people going?
I'm sorry? Well, we're looking forward to find out.
What are you going to
do? We're sort of serving as mutual employment teams, trying to instruct one another. And our children's manager's daughter, for a job, instructs people who have never been very employed before in how to make resumes. So we're learning from her. I have 17 different hats. I teach spinning and knitting at the Art Institute. I teach the women's literature class in an adult ed evening. I have been a substitute reference librarian, and they had said, can you do days? And I said, oh, no, I couldn't do that. Before my husband found out, the person who schedules the substitutes found out by my saying, okay, I so could.
No,
and
when you found out the store was closed?
Yes. It was. I'll tell my husband at some time, but it'll keep. I've got to tell this other guy that I'm available. And during the summer months, I garden for lovely people with money. So that was another advantage of working here. I had huge flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
You just said, I'm not going to be in today, George, but it was assumed that we would figure out who was going to be and who wasn't and get it covered.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody to argue with anymore about the difference between infer and imply.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably why we're really going out of business, is the staff likes arguing language too much.
Well, so that's all she wrote after 61 years, four locations. The last independent in Kalamazoo, do you think there will be another?
I'd love to see it. Maude Newton's blog was interviewing, I think it's David, at Powell's.com, and he wasn't very he was saying certainly, and then was saying used ones. It would be fun. We sort of, if you could just be, instead of being, if I could just be young with what I know now, if we could just be recapitalized with what we know now.
Mm-hmm.
We had just started an e-newsletter. Our website, there used to be a television show, Men Behaving Badly. Mm-hmm. Much funnier is women in their 50s learning HTML. Barb, I just blew away the frames on the main page again. You had a sort of a cubist main page for about a half hour there.
So television would have been the way to go, huh?
I think we're partial to the printed page. But.
Well, we will keep our fingers crossed that some enterprising soul realizes the need for an independent in Kalamazoo, because apparently there's a staff ready and willing to go.
All set to start up again. You bet. We could. The line forms on the left.
Susan, it's bad news, but you're taking it with a great deal of grace. Thanks for talking about the difficult situation there.
Well, thank you for asking. We have good friends, and we're enjoyed being here.
That's it for today's show. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow when our guest is going to be Steve Allman. We're going to be talking about agents. Are they good for you or are they bad for you? You'll be shocked to know that Steve has an opinion that many writers may not agree with. In the meantime, thanks today to Andrew Steinmetz, our engineer, also to Valerie Marions, Becky Kramer, and Kelly Burdick. Kelly, get better soon. We need you here. And in the meanwhile, it's important that everybody else remember that whale is out there, man.